Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is William Harris, a professor of politics at the University of Otago in New Zealand, where he teaches the politics and history of the Levant states. His books include Lebanon, A History, 600 to 2011, and The Levant, A Fractured Mosaic. And his latest book just out is Quicksilver War, Syria, Iraq, and the Spiral of Conflict. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Harris.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And at this point, what I think is so important about your book is that you make the case that the Syria war and the Iraq war are intertwined. And at this point, you have an extraordinary situation where Russian mercenaries recently attacked American Special Forces soldiers, and of course, they got pretty much wiped out. But that in itself, Americans being attacked by Russians, is not something that to be taken lightly. And it's pretty extraordinary how very little has been said over here by the Trump administration, and virtually nothing in Russia is said by Putin about what happened. Meanwhile, on the outer suburbs of Damascus, there's a humanitarian disaster, a horror unfolding. And what's looming on the horizon, I understand, is that the Iranians have trained Shia militia in Iraq, which they plan to send into Syria. And if they do that, the Israelis will bomb them. So this situation, as bad as it is, seems like it's poised to get worse.
I would certainly agree with that. I mean, we have comprehensive involvement now by external parties, and one important one you didn't mention there was, of course, Turkey's operation in the northwestern area of Afrin against the PYD Kurds. So that's in the equation as well, and that also involves Turkey and some disturbance with the United States. So we just add one more onto the scene. As for the continued intertwining of Syria and Iraq, I think you've made a very interesting point there about this push of Shia militias from Iraq into Syria, which of course continues. Ali Akbar Velayati, a senior advisor to the supreme leader in Tehran, recently descended on Baghdad and made it plain that he felt that these militias should also attack the United States on the other side of the Euphrates in Syria. So it's not just the Russian-American thing we're talking about here. It's also obviously on a global level somewhat less important, but also the Iranian-American dimension.
Well, of course, your point is well taken, that the idea of two NATO allies getting into a clash is pretty much unheard of, but nevertheless a real possibility. And ironically, of course, Erdogan, the Turkish leader, is basically propagating anti-Americanism inside of Turkey and you know, cozying up to Turkey's traditional foe, Russia. So it's all rather extraordinary. Now, you go back in history, of course, in your new book, Quicksilver War, Syria, Iraq, and the Spiral of Conflict, William Harris. So it's difficult to know where to begin, but I think the one point you can make is that the Bush, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld intervention in Iraq has been a catastrophe. The only winner of that war is Iran, and the chips are still falling, aren't they?
Yes, I agree. And one major way in which, of course, that feeds into the more recent Syria-Iraq conflagration that I've talked about, obviously, is the legacy of the jihadists that was obviously stirred up in Iraq during the American invasion and occupation. And that, of course, has bedeviled this more recent conflict as well. I think I also make the point in the book that otherwise I don't see a direct connection of what happened in Iraq with what happened in Syria in 2011. I tend to see the Syrian evolution towards the protest movement and then the descent into warfare as a Syrian domestic, very much a Syrian domestic affair, which has then got mixed in with the Iraqi momentum. by 2014, obviously, when ISIS and co. emerged, particularly in eastern Syria.
Well, indeed, the link, I think, with Syria would be with Libya, because the uprising in Syria against the Assad regime and the kind of fact that they basically, that country's been a kind of family plantation run by this kind of mafia family, the fall of Gaddafi inspired the otherwise supine Syrian people to rise up in the streets, and Assad shot them down. And you know, the old joke in Syria was, because of the ubiquitous nature of the Muhabarat, the secret police, is the only time you open your mouth in Syria is when you go to the dentist.
Absolutely. I think it was an input from the North African theatres generally, and that set the Syrians going. Obviously, Egypt and Tunisia had their role as well in triggering the round of protests that started in Deraa in March 2011.
And how Deraa is similar. I know it's not in Damascus, but isn't what's happening now in Ghouta, the outer suburb of Damascus, isn't that a poor working class part of Damascus, and it's just getting mercilessly pounded, and women and children are dying, and the UN have been trying to broker a ceasefire. The Russians blocked it, but now the Russians are saying that they're open to a 5-hour humanitarian window to stop the carnage.
Yeah, I think here we put to, going back to 2011, you put together here the suburbs, the rural areas, the provincial towns, all rather downbeat compared with the inner bourgeois sectors of Damascus and at that time Aleppo, and this was very much the protest movement that turned into an armed uprising was very much a surge from these peripheries, which at that stage were also affected by a quite severe drought, and that those peripheries encompass, I would say, in demographic terms, encompassed more than half of the Sunni Arab population, the majority population of Syria.
So how did this war get co-opted, at least in terms of the revolution itself, by the jihadis, by the Saudis and others who see it as a proxy war? Because the best thing that happened to Assad was ISIS and these jihadi al-Nusra groups coming in, because Assad was able to say, it's either me or the terrorists.
Yes, I mean, the Sunni Arab opposition was always very poorly cohered, very poorly. And there was an opportunity there for people from outside, like, as you mentioned, the Saudis, the Qataris, Kuwaiti private financiers, an element of Turkish involvement, that they, together with Bashar, pushing the Sunni Arab population to the wall, I would say. You also had these people encouraging the more extreme and Salafist elements amongst the opposition, which then trended in this radical religious direction, and melded, of course, with what was happening in Iraq. And Bashar, of course, also at that stage, 2012, pulled back from eastern Syria because of a strong challenge he was facing at that point in Damascus and Aleppo. And that, of course, left a vacuum which the jihadists moved into, and we also had the PYD Kurds asserting themselves in the northeastern part of that area. But the opening up of that area, which was critical, I think, to the jihadist momentum, that they acquired this new base area in eastern Syria and were able to bring foreign jihadis across a quite porous Turkish border to the north. And then we're able to feed all that back into Iraq itself.
Well, the irony is now, of course, that underground railroad of foreign jihadis that went through Turkey was organized by Turkey's intelligence service, the MEK. And now even Turkey has taken our eye off the ball in terms of of finishing off the Islamic State and al-Nusra and these various jihadi militias because they're attacking the Kurds, and the situation in Afrin is complicating it. But meanwhile, the jihadis apparently been slipping out of the war zone, out of the net where they would otherwise have been extinguished, into Turkey and back into Europe. And now the French are concerned that there are hundreds of these trained killers returning.
Yes, that certainly seems to be pretty obvious. And one of the things that the United States is right about in this conflict is that the ISIS dimension isn't finished yet. That they still have problems down the Euphrates Valley towards the Iraqi border. And of course, we have a little ISIS enclave or people who have associated themselves with ISIS, even on the southern edge of the Golan Heights and that area. So we still have pockets and possibilities for assertion by radical jihadist terrorist elements. We continue to have that possibility in Syria, as I don't think just the Turks, as others have taken deliberately their eyes off the ball. Of course, when the Russians intervened in 2015, they said this was against jihadis and so forth. But of course, their real target was anybody fighting against Bashar al-Assad, who of course may have been quite hardline Islamists, but not jihadis. But they were the targets, and the Russians quite cynically used that they were really coming in against the hardline terrorist elements, which of course were present.
Yeah, well, of course, the Russians, obviously their interests are the same interests that the Soviets had, which is their naval base there in Tartus and the air base as well in Latakia, right?
Yes, and I think they have a broader interest in their general reassertion as a great power, and that other people take notice of that, and that other people are compelled to involve them in the treatment of problems around the world, and particularly ones that are rather close to their own environment, obviously like Syria. So I think there's also, from the Russian point of view, and certainly from Putin's point of view, a sort of reputational assertion here.
Sure. But just in the last couple of minutes, though, what can we make of this extraordinary clash that took part, where the Wagners, which are a mercenary group paid for and led by Putin's billionaire crony Prigozhin, who also owns and financed the troll farm in St. Petersburg that the special counsel Robert Mueller named in his recent indictment of interfering in our elections. Prigozhin's mercenaries, I think about 500 strong, along with the Syrian Fifth Corps, attacked a Kurdish base with 12 U.S. Special Forces soldiers, who then brought in air power and wiped them out. But the very puzzling thing is, who gave the Russians mercenaries permission to attack the Americans, and why did the Russians not give them air cover? Those questions have not been answered.
Well, I think we have some involvement here by the Syrian regime, that the Syrian regime may have been acting as a provocative agent, one might say, and came into the line and maybe covered these people and even twisted the communications around a bit. So it may be we haven't heard much about Syrian regime involvement in this thing, but I think there's the possibility that there was a finger here.
Well, that seems to be the case, that the Russian, the deconfliction arrangement they have with the Americans, the Americans said, these are Russians, and they said, no, they're Syrians, Fifth Corps. So,
yes, I recall that. I agree with you.
Yeah.
And we also have the Syrian regime trying to take advantage of the Afrin situation.
Right.
By pushing people towards Afrin town, and the Turks, of course, have reacted pretty badly to that, but I understand quite a number of fighters, of regime-linked elements, and possibly Shia militias, have penetrated into the Afrin area. And one thing the Turks don't want any more than they want the Kurdish presence there is an Iranian Shia militia presence coming in. And the irony is that Turkey may well have opened the gateways to that by what it's doing.
And we know that that the Israelis will bomb the hell out of those militias if they head towards Syria and Lebanon. So the war could get wider, and I guess that's a note to end on.
Yes, absolutely. And there's no sign or hope of real political progress on virtually any horizon. Particularly, of course, the United States has no vision of where this might end up, apart from simply making a holding operation vis-a-vis ISIS involving the northeastern Syrian Kurds. The United States seems to have no concept of where this might evolve to and where the U.S. might like it to evolve to and how one might get to that point. There's no strategic direction, no strategic vision whatsoever.
Well, we've always known what we didn't want, but we've never known what we wanted. And, of course, we opened the door with that disastrous invasion of Iraq. So I thank you for joining us, William Harris.
Oh, well, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with William Harris, who's a professor of politics at the University of Otago in New Zealand, where he teaches the politics and history of the Levant states. His books include Lebanon, A History, 600 to 2011, and The Levant, A Fractured Mosaic. And his latest book just out is Quicksilver War, Syria, Iraq, and the Spiral of Conflict. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was